this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Massachusetts Senate President Stanley Rosenberg. Senator Rosenberg was elected 93rd President of the Massachusetts Senate by his colleagues in January 2015, to the Massachusetts Senate in 1991, and to the Massachusetts House in 1987. Senator Rosenberg has held his leadership position, including Majority Leader and Chair of the Senate Committee on Ways and Means. Senate President Rosenberg is a 1977 graduate of UMass Amherst, where he earned a BA in Community Development and Arts Management. Shortly after graduating, he began his work in public service as an aide to former state senator and congressman John Oliver. Senator Rosenberg is a self-proclaimed workaholic and can often be found attending church suppers and community meetings, enjoying farmers markets, auctioning pies, and exploring new restaurants in his spare time. He enjoys gardening, reading, traveling, languages, and cooking, especially his, quote, famous tomato sauce. He lives in Amherst with his spouse, Brian. We'll talk to Senate President Stan Rosenberg about all of that. But first, welcome, Senator.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be on with you.
Well, we've wanted to do this for a long time. You know, you are a hero to many people in Massachusetts who feel that you have been a trailblazer in so many ways. But what I like to do is find out how you came up. Where were you born? Who were your parents? And what were their influence on you?
Well, born in Boston, grew up in the Massachusetts foster care system in a home in Malden and then Revere, graduated from Revere High School in 1967, applied to a number of colleges, got into a number of colleges, but the only college that gave me any financial aid was the University of Massachusetts. And having just left the foster care system, which at the time you aged out at 18 and you were independent and had to make your own way in the world at that time.
Wow.
So the only option I had was UMass, and it turned out to be a great choice for me. I was a slow learner. It took me 10 years to get my bachelor's degree, but along the way I had some really exciting and fun experiences, and including starting grinder trucks on the UMass Amherst campus.
That's
and
great.
Taking a break and working at a barbecue chicken place, and then coming back to UMass, where as a work-study job, I was given the opportunity to develop a program to extend the university's arts resources into the community. It grew into a full-time job while I went to school part-time for the last, well, more than 60 credits. So more than half of my degree I earned part-time as I worked full-time building that arts organization, which is still going, the Arts Extension Service at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst.
Well, let's go back to the foster care. That's fascinating. How did that happen? How did you get into foster care?
Well, you know, some people, their family situation is such that the parents can't take care of the children. I don't know the fine detail of it, but at a very, very young age, earlier than I can remember, I and my siblings found themselves spread in different families around the Boston area, and ended up staying in foster care until I aged out at 18.
You are Jewish, of course. Rosenberg's
yes.
Jewish name. What was that like? I mean, when you were in foster care, was there any attention given to religion or your roots?
So I went to a Hebrew school, and the family was a Jewish family, and went to Hebrew school and had my bar mitzvah. And in fact, at one point, I was trying to head in the direction of becoming a rabbi. I did not get into Yeshiva University. Had I gotten into Yeshiva, I probably would not have gone into politics. I probably would have been an aging rabbi at this time.
So you obviously have something in your character that has allowed you to make your way in politics with a lot of approval from your colleagues. Where does that come from? Is that part of your character? Is that something that happened from the very beginning, or is that something you had to learn?
Well, I think when you grow up in foster care, you basically learn independence pretty early in life because you're in an unusual circumstance. You often don't know why you're there. You have a lot of questions about that, but you build resiliency. You adapt to your surroundings, and you find some key people who basically end up being your guides and your mentors, and I'm not sure that that's much different than most other people would experience, but it's perhaps more critical and more meaningful because you don't have parents to turn to get that kind of affirmation and support and encouragement. And so you make your way along, but you find that you grow up very early, very fast. And it, I think for many who succeed in the foster care system, you basically become so self-reliant, and so you develop a set of skills and capacity maybe earlier than others, so you're kind of getting a little head start on life and maybe a little head start even on adulthood, because you're having to show some of the same characteristics at a very young age that you would expect to see in people older and into early adulthood. So, you know, I've always worked hard. I sometimes work 2 and 3 jobs of necessity and learn to be, you know, a reliable professional person trying to excel at what I'm doing. And I think it just sort of became part of my nature. If it's not part of my nature, it at least became part of my character, as you were just suggesting. And it's carried me quite far.
Are you tough? Do you ever get into fights, or did you ever?
No, actually, I almost never did. But, you know, the general perception is that if you are a state kid, as they used to be called, or a ward of the state, or a foster kid, that there's something somehow wrong with you, and therefore you have to work a lot harder to prove yourself and to sort of rise above, because most foster kids are assumed to be headed toward an undistinguished life and maybe an undesirable way of life. And so I never found myself fighting with people. I always found myself trying to be successful from a very early age. And so, no, I didn't get in a lot of fights, but I knew that I was different, and I knew that people looked at me as though I was different.
Why were you different?
Well, because you're not in a traditional family situation. And when you were growing up in the 40s, 50s, 60s, there was a stigma attached to being in foster care, to being a state kid. There's something wrong with you, or you wouldn't be there. And because there's something wrong with you, you're probably not going to go very far in life. And, you know, you just have to work hard to prove that you have capacity and that you're worth paying attention to and given a chance like everyone else.
Stan Rosenberg, has this given you, as a top legislator, the top in the Senate, has this given you a responsibility for, do you think, for making sure that other foster kids don't have a rough time?
So, as a freshman state representative in 1987, one of my colleagues walked up to me and said, "I understand you were in the Massachusetts foster care system." And I said, "Yes." And she said, "So was I." And then she said, "Do you know that there are 2 others right now serving in the chamber, 4 out of 160 who are former foster kids?" And I was quite surprised, because if you think about the statistics of the number of children who grow up in foster care, to have 4 out of 160 serving in the House of Representatives at the same time was pretty remarkable. We formed the first in the nation foster kid caucus for the purpose of trying to motivate and encourage foster kids to see that there is life after foster care, that you can be successful in life, and to maybe try to give individuals and the class as a whole of children growing up in foster care some hope and some vision for a better future. And very quickly we were thrust instead into investigations about relating to the deaths or harm that had come to children in the foster care system. And that foster kid caucus, which was supposed to be a sort of a fun and sort of light-hearted, it's turned into something far more serious. Wow. As we found ourselves in the middle of all kinds of conflict about what was wrong with our foster care system in Massachusetts, which after years of study and work, we realized it's the same everywhere. Foster care systems all across the country are stressed, dealing with families in the most extraordinarily challenging situations with unpredictable results, both in the foster homes and in the biological homes. And we spent more than 20 years improving our laws, budget allocations, policies, as well as trying to inspire these young folks. So now in Massachusetts, when you come out of the foster care system, you as a young person at 18 can actually ask that you remain in the system until age 25, or as many years as you choose between 18 and 25.
And what does
you
that do?
You can now also go to public college or university at no cost.
Wow.
So that you have a chance as a foster kid to actually get a higher education, which is a gateway to opportunity. So those are some of the kinds of things that we've done here in Massachusetts as a result of the existence of the Foster Kid Caucus.
Let me ask you a question, Stan Rosenberg. Did you ever trace down your parents?
Oh, yeah. I saw them for periods of time as a young person and basically had some connection until just about age 14. And after that, the connection was broken.
And with your siblings?
Yeah. Some of them, not all of them.
Huh. Fascinating. From a psychoanalytic point of view, or from a personal point of view, were you angry?
No, you know, no, I wasn't. Just living and making my way. You know, every day you had to get up and make life work.
You're the president of the Massachusetts Senate, very powerful position. You've seen a lot of governors come and go in all of your capacities, whether Senate president or not, and you've had to make that work. What's it like working for Charlie Baker, who I see as a Republican, if ever there was one? In other words, I don't see him being outside the realm of former Republican governors in New York State.
Well, you know, you're a great student of history and government, and so here in Massachusetts, except for two periods, one for 2 years and one for four in the 1800s, governors in Massachusetts and legislatures were Republican. It was a unified Republican government, except for those two periods. And then in the very late 1940s was when the Massachusetts House finally became, for the first time in 20th century politics, had become a Democratic chamber. And a few years later, the Senate followed suit. So we in Massachusetts think, well, Democrats have owned the legislature forever. Well, the truth is, we've only had it for about 70 years, but our governors have continued to be, more often than not, Republicans, even through most of the 20th century. So I've worked with more Republican governors than Democratic governors, and we've had a divided government with Republican governors and Democratic legislature my entire life and all the time I've known politics. And I would say that except for Governor Romney, all of them, I think, would fit the description you just gave, which is most of them have been socially progressive and fiscally moderate to conservative. So we've had this long history in Massachusetts of having Republican governors who in many states would have been Democrats. Charlie Baker is no exception to that.
So what's that all about? Blue state Massachusetts, I am a constituent too because I live in Great Barrington. And blue state Massachusetts, who regularly elect Republicans. Is that because the Democrats, I'm going to be as provocative as I can here, because the Democrats put up lousy candidates for governor?
We've had some pretty good people, you know, Michael Dukakis and Deval Patrick, but no, people in Massachusetts like this divided government. We have an overwhelmingly Democratic legislature. 85% to 90% of the members in a typical cycle are Democrats, and they elect Republican governors, and more often than not, they elect Republican treasurers these days.
Sure.
I mean, we do have a Democrat right now, Deb Goldberg, but we've had either conservative Democrat treasurers or Republican treasurers, and so they tend to take the two positions that deal with the money in the among the constitutional officers, and they tend to put Republicans in. Not universally, not all the time, but there's a tendency to go in that direction, and we've made divided government in Massachusetts work pretty well. In fact, in many periods, if you would ask them, they would say, people would reflect that it looked like the Democrats, when we had the corner office as well as the legislature, were not getting along as well as when we had a Republican in the governor's office and a Democratic legislature.
So you lead me to ask you the question about which is the more conservative house, the House of Representatives, the lower house, or the Senate?
So that has alternated over time. During a long period of time, Bill Bulger, who was the longest-serving Senate president at the time, 16 years, and during most of his period, people would have said that the Senate was the more conservative. He was anti-choice, anti-gay rights, pro public funding for parochial schools, et cetera, and the House was the foil against those things. And in the most recent times, we had Tom Birmingham, who followed Bulger, and for 8 years, the Senate was the more liberal. And then came Bob Travellini, and followed by Therese Murray, and they were more moderate Democrats. And now we are described as the left-leaning Senate because the governor is the one on the right. If we do the continuum, he's the one on the right. The House is right of center, and the Senate is left of center. But remember, Massachusetts was the last state in the country to legalize contraception.
Right.
It was not the pioneering state in anti-discrimination statutes. We had busing and racial issues in the middle of the 20th century, and LGBT rights and anti-discrimination statutes were very hard won, and we were not the pioneers. We came along later in the order of states that adopted. So we are blue state, we have that reputation, but we have been historically, socially quite conservative, our roots going back to the Puritans, apparently. We were having trouble shaking the blue laws and the, you know, for Sunday sales and contraception and a whole series of social policy innovations took a long time to take hold in Massachusetts. But right now, they say it's the left-leaning Senate and the House is right of center and the governor is further right.
We're talking with Massachusetts Senate President Stanley Rosenberg. Senator, I guess the next question is, covering New York politics for a long time, in which many people don't have the slightest idea who their legislators are. And I mean,
same here.
Well, you know, it's fascinating because in our Western Massachusetts, I know you guys think that Western Massachusetts starts at 128, but we, you know, we consider ourselves the furthest west and the rest of it. Our representatives, for example, Smitty Pignatelli or guys like Adam Hines or Mr. Downing, we love them. I mean, everybody knows who they are. And you go to them and ask them for things, and they get them for you. So is that unique for the way we cover politics?
Well, you know, the more urban settings, I think you're right. People are less aware of who their legislators are, and they're, you know, right down the middle of a street can divide a district. And so the person on the left side of the street is with Representative so-and-so, and on the right side, it's Representative what's-his-name. And so people can be confused just by that simple situation. But, yeah, out in our areas, and you can go to southeastern Mass, northeastern Mass, and Worcester County, central Massachusetts, you'll hear the same tune. People will say we're being ignored. Boston gets all the attention, Route 128, anybody inside the Metro West to Boston belt gets all the resources, gets all the attention. Well, you know, 2.4 million people live in that area out of the 6.7 million people of the state. So it is pretty easy. You know, they're all a stone's throw from the Capitol. So people outside do tend to feel like they're being ignored. We work very hard as legislators who live outside of the area. I live in Amherst, which is not so far away from Great Barrington where you are. We have to work together as a delegation because there are more people who represent parts of Boston in the legislature than the entire five western counties of Massachusetts.
Of course, yeah.
So if we don't stick together, work together, and support each other, then we're going to have problems. And we often make alliance with people in southeastern Massachusetts and northeastern Massachusetts in order to build our numbers so that our needs and our interests can be reflected in the policies that are made. And the Senate started a new thing 2 years ago, 3 years ago now. Right after I got elected Senate President, we decided to start a program called Commonwealth Conversations, where we divided the state up into 8 regions. This time we did 9 regions this year. And the senators in those regions organized a complete day of activities. And the rule of thumb is you participate in the one in your region, but you go to at least 2 other regions, hopefully regions you've never visited before, to see things and experience things that you may never have heard of or you may have heard of but never done, and see the perspective from the point of view of people living in those regions. Thousands of people turn out for these meetings and forums that we conduct as part of the Commonwealth Conversations Tour. each of those days culminates with an open public forum. 150 to 300 people show up, and anybody can speak for 2 minutes on any subject they want. And the members of the Senate, and it's usually a third to more than half of the Senate, is sitting there in front of those people listening, not asking questions, not making speeches, listening to the perspectives and the needs and the wants and the aspirations of people throughout the Commonwealth. That has opened up civic engagement and transparency and given us the opportunity to travel to all parts of the state so that the people understand that we're hearing them, and so that the members, each of whom either chairs a committee in the Senate or is in a leadership position, when they think statewide, they have frame of reference beyond their own district.
It'll be great to see you in Great Barrington. We're going to be looking forward to that.
Well, we can do that in a future round. We hopefully will do it again at the beginning of the next term.
Yeah, great.
So send me a note and remind me, or call Adam and remind him.
Yeah, we will. He's a great guy and he's a good friend. Okay, so the next question is perhaps the most important person in Massachusetts history. Of course, there were a lot of them, the Adamses and all the rest of them, but there was Elbridge Gerry. You know what I mean?
Oh.
The great inventor of the gerrymander. I once asked one of your predecessors, we were on a stage together getting honored for something or other, and I asked her about gerrymandering in Massachusetts, and I think she got a little annoyed with me and said, we don't do that here. So do we gerrymander in Massachusetts?
We follow the constitutionally prescribed rules, not only on race, but on the broader questions. I think most people would say, who really look at this very carefully, that Massachusetts is not gerrymandering. And the reason for that is because we're actually following the rules. Now, some people might want to debate whether adhering to communities of interest and tradition is, by definition, a form of gerrymandering, and other people would look at that same situation and say, no, that is in fact the antidote to gerrymandering. I did redistricting twice. I was chair of the Senate redistricting twice, and none of the maps that we drew in the Senate in those two redistricting cycles were challenged in court. In fact, on the contrary, they were praised by the very constituency groups who would normally take you to court, saying that you had gerrymandered, either done racial or political gerrymandering. And in fact, that did not happen. And in fact, the second redistricting, the House maps did not go to court either. So when we did the last redistricting, we were one of about a quarter of the states did not go to court, and Massachusetts was one of those states. A legislative redistricting commission that did work, that ended up getting praise from the minority organizations, as well as Common Cause and League of Women Voters, the traditional groups who watch and participate in the redistricting, had nothing but praise for what we've done. So communities of interest and tradition are two elements that the courts recognize are tools that you should use in redistricting to make sure that you don't break up communities of interest that are working together as political units and political entities to meet the needs of the public, in our case, in our state, our Commonwealth. And so I think when you follow those rules and you adhere to them strictly, you can avoid gerrymandering. And that's why I think whoever it was who said that to you was saying, we don't gerrymander, because we're actually following the rules and the prescriptions offered by the courts.
So, but it's fraught with danger. You have to make decisions, right?
Yes.
So in other words,
that is correct.
In other words, you have to say, okay, let's just assume for a second that you want to make sure that the people of color population in Massachusetts elect representatives following their interests. We do know that under traditional gerrymandering, there are always those who try to split those folks up. So they don't have anybody, but you have to make that decision, right?
That is correct, and that's where the judgment comes in, and you can do it the right way or you can do it the wrong way. So in the case of the Senate, four redistrictings ago, there was enough population change in Boston not to create a second minority-majority district in Boston. Now, there was a white incumbent. That district was drawn strictly according to the rules laid down by the Supreme Court. All the analysis showed that it was a minority-majority district. That district continued to elect the white incumbent because incumbents tend to stay in power. When we did the next redistricting, the population had grown even more in Boston. We were able to perfect that district. When that white incumbent took another job, he was replaced by an African-American woman. So if you do it right, the system sets up the opportunity for minority candidates to advance. Doesn't guarantee it, and doesn't guarantee it in the long run or the short run, but when you do it right, it usually does work out. The House of Representatives in Massachusetts, the last redistricting, based on the growth of minority populations, doubled the number of minority-majority districts in the House, and those districts are beginning to elect people of color as people either leave, as white candidates or incumbents leave, or as minority communities build enough political strength, not just population, but political strength to elect minorities. So it does work. Remember back to Mr. Weld, when he got enough Republicans elected to the Senate that he could sustain his vetoes, which gave him enough power that he actually gerrymandered two Republican districts for Congress in Massachusetts. In the next election, two Republicans were elected. Two elections later, those same districts voted out the two Republicans. There's never been another Republican in either of those districts, even though they were gerrymandered to be Republican districts, because the people in those districts, they found in the Democratic candidates the people that really were representing their views.
Okay.
And there was no additional gerrymandering.
So, Stan Rosenberg, I'm finding this to be a really fabulous time for me, at least, because I'm learning a lot. And I really love the idea that you're being as frank as you are and telling us what you're telling us. So I want to go to the Department of Gossip now. Gossip. Okay. You mentioned before that one of your predecessors was Mr. Bulger.
Yes.
And there was common knowledge that he and his brother, Whitey, may have, you know, known where each other were and all the rest of it. I've met him at Tanglewood, a courtly guy, always interesting. But what was it like serving under a guy who was, you know, the brother of Whitey, the infamous Whitey Bulger?
Well, you know, there's a lot of storytelling and a lot of projection around all of that. What I found in dealing with him as a newly elected senator, and by the way, this was toward the end of his period as Senate president, so maybe he was mellowing a little, but people told me that I was too liberal for him. He would immediately see me as John Oliver Light and would basically dismiss me because I was coming out of Amherst and therefore must be just another one of those crazy liberals. And what I found instead was when I went in after I got elected, and it was a special election because John Oliver replaced Silvio Conti when he passed, and so I replaced John Oliver through a special election in the Senate, and he said, "What would you like to chair?" And I said, "Ways and Means," and when we both stopped laughing, he said, "No, seriously," and I said, "Okay, I've looked at who's got two chairmanships. I know what the entry-level committees are, and the only committee that I think would be within my reach at this point would be election laws, but you'd be nuts to name me to election laws because I'd want to make some changes." 2 weeks later, he calls me to the office and he said, "Congratulations, this afternoon you're going to be named chair of the election laws committee." Knock me over with a feather. I mean, go figure. I come back to him a few weeks later, having looked around and figured out what was going on, and I said, "You know, Common Cause is going to the ballot on election laws, campaign finance reform, rather, and they're going to put a $100 limit on campaign contributions and increased disclosure. Wouldn't it be better if the legislature worked with them and we came up with a good bill in the legislature rather than on the ballot?" And then Motor Voter was about to pass in Washington, and I said, "We're going to have to come into compliance with that." And so he said, "Well, you better get to work on those things." And by the end of that period of time, which was a little over 2 years, we ended up successfully negotiating with Common Cause and then doing Motor Voter, which when we started the work on coming into compliance, we were one of the 10 worst states in the country for voter registration laws, very anti-voter. And by the time we finished, we were among the 10 best, most progressive states. And so, you know, go figure. Everybody thought, I'm never going to get along with him. He's not going to support anything I'm interested in. He gives me a chairmanship that, you know, by rights he shouldn't have given me, and it worked. And so I found my experience working with him was that he let the chairs be chairs. He let you figure out what needed to be done. If he saw you were reliable and could do a decent job, he pretty much left you alone. You knew if the phone rang and he had a request, you knew that you'd better take that very seriously. But I got no interference in either of those bills, and those were very, very sensitive matters for incumbent politicians.
Well, you've led me to a point like Hoot Gibson used to come to at the end of the Westerns, in which there were three roads to go down, and each of them are fascinating. Back to the gossip for a second. So there was an awareness that Whitey was his brother, but nobody opened their mouths yaps about that during that time.
Correct.
Okay.
It was not discussed in the building at all. You knew if you were heard, the walls have ears, we say around here, and there are no secrets. Those are the two fundamental rules you learn the week you come into this building to either work as a staffer or you're sworn into office. There are no secrets in the building, and the walls have ears. Nobody talked about that.
I love
around
it.
Here.
I love it. Okay, down a different road. You just mentioned something. New York State, of course, has a pretty bad political system. I've been covering it for a lot of years. And one of the things I keep recommending, if they were to have a constitutional convention, which is demanded under our state constitution every 20 years, is that you're going to have to have initiative and referendum and maybe term limits. Let's leave term limits out for now. Let's talk about initiative and referendum. You just showed us how, if it's going to go before the voters, you got a choice. You can either do it yourself or you can let the voters do it. What's the deal?
Our legislative processes are deliberative and require us, not by rules but by circumstance, to bring the stakeholders to the table. You get a better product and a better result if you do it through the legislative process and you do it right than if you do it on the ballot. Because when you do it on the ballot, 10 people in Massachusetts sign a petition that they wrote. They are under no obligation to consult with anyone other than the people who agree with them. They write it from their own perspective. They may or may not have any experience with government or how to run something that they're going to try to get done and put in place through the initiative process. And then they go out and they gather, in our case, about 70,000 certified signatures. And then if the legislature fails to act, they get another 12 or 15,000, and now it goes on the ballot. It's an up or down vote. It can't be amended by the voters. And if you ever read Derailing Democracy, mm-hmm. David Broder's book, he has a fantastic analysis of how the moneyed interests and the professionals have now taken control of what in 1917 and 15 in the early part of the 20th century was a mechanism that was established to put power back in the hands of the people so that in legislatures where they were not listening to the people, that the public would have a way of going around the legislature. And it worked for a period of time. It's now the captive of people with money, the social and political scientists who know how to manipulate the wording of ballot questions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And whoever spends the most money usually wins. So you have all of these things. And now you end up with a law that was written from the perspective of one group in society, and now everybody has to live under those rules. So I always push in the direction of trying to get the legislature to act, and increasingly groups are using the initiative petition process to leverage the legislature into acting. They don't want to go on the ballot. They don't want to gather the signatures. They don't want to spend money on passing the law on the ballot. They just want the legislature to act, and so they threaten to use the ballot if we don't act. there are experiences like the very first political stuff I was involved in was the bottle bill in Massachusetts, when after 15 years or so, the legislature refused to take up the bottle bill in the 80s. Mm-hmm. They went to the ballot and they passed a bottle law in Massachusetts. Similarly, we've been through three ballot questions in Massachusetts around marijuana, because marijuana is a third, we call it a third rail issue. Political people don't want to take up drug-related legislation, and so we decriminalized, then we did medical marijuana, and now we did recreational marijuana, all by the voters because it wouldn't have happened otherwise. So the initiative petition should be rarely used. It should be used when you can't get the legislature to act on something you want to do, but because it's usually from the perspective of one group in society, you don't have the benefit of the negotiated process of the legislature to engage stakeholders, and therefore you end up coming back into the legislature later and having to change and perfect some of these ballot questions, as we just did with marijuana here in Massachusetts.
It's a good case study. Could you just frame it for us for a couple of seconds?
Yeah. Legalize, regulate, and tax marijuana. Bills filed year after year after year, doesn't go anywhere. Finally, two different groups put two different ballot questions forward. One of them ends up on the ballot. The voters approved it by, let's say, 54-55% of the vote, which is pretty healthy. And then the advocates say, don't touch the ballot question. And many other constituency groups say, please perfect it. And in this case, the governor, the speaker, and I all said during the campaign period, if this does pass, we are going to delay it and fix it. When it passed, we did exactly that. In December, we delayed it for 6 months, not the legalization of it in home growing, only the taxation, regulation, and licensing. And we just passed legislation a few weeks ago that got signed into law. And a year from now, that improved bill will be the basis for the issuing of licenses to shops for either cultivation or retail sales of marijuana products.
What if it turns out that everybody was wrong? You know, I mean, I voted for it, but what if it turns out everybody was wrong, that people are crashing into each other or, you know, being stopped and there's no real adequate test for whether they were under the influence or not, and whether people like our brilliant Jennifer Michaels in Western Massachusetts, who is our go-to person on this stuff, turns out to be right, that it is a gateway drug and more people are going into bad drugs as a result of marijuana. Then what do you do?
The people have spoken, and we have to work within the structure that they put forward. People must have been crashing into each other with alcohol in the 18 and 1900s, and society adapted. We came up with rules. We came up with systems. We came up with tests, blah, blah, blah. So the same thing is going to happen with marijuana. Could somebody come to the legislature and say this is a disaster, repeal it? Of course. We have the right of free petition in Massachusetts. Count on it. Somebody eventually is going to do that. Does that mean the legislature is going to take it up? We rarely overturn and repeal a law that's been approved by the voters. We amend them. We make changes based on real-life experience, but we rarely repeal. I can only think of one in the 40 years that I've been watching politics that got overturned and repealed by the legislature.
So, come on now. Let's have some fun. Take us into the inner sanctum when you, the House Speaker, and the governor got together to decide on that. How'd that conversation go?
Well, first it started with coffee and
Danish
and cake, yeah. Oh, I mean, we meet every Monday afternoon, virtually every Monday afternoon, to talk about legislation and policy and directions that we're going in, would like to go in, problems that the governor sees emerging, problems that we may see emerging. And so we have open, frank conversations with the lieutenant governor, governor, speaker, senate president, the minority leaders, and the ways and means chairs of both the House and the Senate. So there are
a lot of people,
10 of us in the room, and we have frank discussions. Now, they don't bleed outside of the room until we're ready to discuss publicly what we've been exploring. And most of what we discuss eventually does become public, not by leaks or anything like that, but by intention. once we're ready to discuss it, because we've either figured out a path forward or we realize that we're not going to agree on this or that, whatever it is, but then we start having the conversation in public so that people can start hearing and seeing where the disagreements may be. And then eventually we find common ground almost always to be able to find a way to move forward.
So do you like each other?
Yeah, we do. But, you know, we disagree. I mean, the governor's a Republican. The Senate is adhering to what we learn in the Commonwealth conversations, which tends to be very close to what the Democratic Party platform is. And I'm a life member of the Democratic State Committee, so I'm very much into party building and into that sort of thing. So we, you know, we have our disagreements, but we've pledged to each other not to be disagreeable. We don't make it personal.
So here's a Republican who's sort of on the hot seat, because if anybody is abhorred in Massachusetts, it's got to be the present president. How do you see him walking that tightrope?
It's really challenging. I mean, he did not support him for president, and, you know, he's been forthright about that. And, you know, it's got to be difficult for him, because at the same time, he has to negotiate with his administration on behalf of the Commonwealth. So we all wear both hats. We have our political hat and we have our governing hat. And so we have to be very clear when we're speaking with our political hat on versus our governing hat on. And I would say 90% of the time we're wearing our governing hat on, because it's our job to make things work.
Let me put it this way, Senate President Stan Rosenberg. Oh, come on. What's it really like to be with Governor Baker?
You know, he's not president yet. So.
No, with Governor, and he's not going to be president. He can't, having alienated all those right wingers there by being with you guys as much as he is, which I approve of, by the way. That's what they always say. You know, Shartak, what's he really like? So what's the guy really like?
He's a policy wonk. He's a numbers guy. He's data driven. He comes with very strong opinions, but if you come up with data and you come up with something that he hasn't thought about, he will stop, he will listen, and he may change.
Okay, I want to go to a different place, because we are running out of time, which kills me. And Stan Rosenberg, I hope sometime in the far future, or not so far future, you'll come back and spend some more time with us. But my question now is about committee chairmanships. You touched on that before when we were talking about Bulger giving you what you wanted. But you must be on the hot seat with everybody trying to compete for what you give them.
Every committee chairmanship, every leadership position in the Senate is being turned into an opportunity to perform and to do meaningful work. And we had a very centralized system for the last 25, 30 years, and I'm in the process of decentralizing it again, pretty much along the lines of, and now don't get me wrong, it's not identical, but along the lines of what I described of what I experienced with Bill Bulger, which is you go figure out what needs to get done. I'm giving you the job. You go figure it out, and you come back and tell us how to do this, and if it makes sense, we're going to move it forward. That's the kind of approach we're doing now, and this Commonwealth Conversations that I described earlier is part of our agenda setting process, because after we come off the road from the Commonwealth Conversations tour, we put together a report. The report is the guide document for our policy work for the term, and we ask each of the chairs to go back to their committees and now find legislation that, whether they wrote it or someone else wrote it, that will help address the issues and the aspirations that people told us in the Commonwealth Conversations. And then we work together to advance that agenda. So it's not a top-down agenda setting process. And there's a group of seven senators that decides what's going to go onto the floor for debate, not one senator, as has happened in other periods of time when leadership is centralized in the Speaker and Senate President's offices. So, yeah, there are chairmanships. Everybody wants to be chair of Ways and Means, or let's say most people want to be chair of Ways and Means. And a lot of people would want to be chair of this, that, or the other. And those are tough decisions. In the end, it's my job to make those recommendations, and the caucus votes on whether to accept those recommendations. Fortunately, they do accept those, and there's always another day. If you don't get it this time, it might be open next time. Because remember, In America, legislators serve on average 10 years. 10 years, which means there's a lot of turnover, roughly 10% turnover in every election cycle, 10 to 20% turnover. And therefore, if you're around here long enough and you get here at the right time, you're going to have many different opportunities along the road over the years that you're here.
Yeah, but I was talking more about the politics of not what happens when you get there, but how you get there. In other words, Adam Hines, my friend and the state senator from my area, brand new guy, but he still gets the tourism committee, which is a tremendous thing for the Berkshires.
Absolutely. He asked for it, and I could do it, so I did it.
Well, but you could have also not done it. It wasn't
That's
done
correct.
Before.
Why would I not do it?
Well, because other people...
He's a talented guy.
Yeah.
It works for his district, and typically it's one of those committees that is specialized enough that there's only a small number of senators who would really want it as their first choice. So if you can give it to somebody for whom it's their first choice, why wouldn't you do it?
Indeed, that's exactly right. I only have 4 minutes left, but I want to get you because the president has now spoken on Afghanistan. It's pretty clear to me that he has given his government over to the generals. You know, out go the ideologues, in come the generals. There's a suspicion on my part his numbers may go up as a result of a more moderated guy who is reading what they give him to read. Is there anything dangerous about generals running the government?
We're not used to that in this society. The most recent experience with that would have been, I believe, Mr. Eisenhower, and people felt he did a very good job as president of the United States, and maybe because of his military background, or in spite of it, depending upon how you want to look at it, but he did some good things for the country, and he acted as a civilian, even though he had military background, when he served as president, and we have to assume that those who are not in uniform are going to act as civilians. But I have to say, obviously, we are in a very perilous period here.
Sure.
Which is very worrisome when you have the kinds of activities we saw in the last couple of weeks, and you have a president who can't separate right from wrong and blames, I don't know, just puts in the same bucket people who are protesting against bigotry and hatred, puts in the same bucket with people who are fomenting prejudice and hatred, and he can't separate that out and recognize his position of moral leadership here. It's a very dangerous time.
So obviously Massachusetts is really quite upset about this particular president, and you are channeling them, do you think, in terms of your words, your work?
You know, the governor, the speaker, and I have repeatedly spoken out when things happened in Washington that were counter to the interests and values of the people of the Commonwealth, and we're going to continue to do that. And our attorney general is among the leading voices using her position with other attorneys general around the country to make sure that she's using her power to protect our interests and values here in the Commonwealth. And that will continue because it has to continue. We are not an island. On the other hand, we've been a state, an innovative state, or the state of innovation here for centuries, and we're going to continue providing moral and political and social leadership whenever we can. We're in a particularly challenging period. It's our responsibility as leaders to make sure that we speak clearly, forcefully, directly about what we see wrong and what we see right, and do everything we can to protect our collective values and interests.
So, Stan Rosenberg, let me ask you this. We have seen Charlottesville and the statues. Is there any statue you could think of that needs to come down in Massachusetts?
Wow, I have not thought about that. No, I can't think of a statue in Massachusetts off the top of my head that I would think should be taken down. We have had some incidents in my district with some Confederate flags flying in people's yards or even posted in their garage, and it's really been interesting, the discussion and the dynamic that created in our communities. And in one case, the homeowner decided to take it down, and in the other case, the homeowner decided not to take it down. and the community just let it be for a period of time, and then he took it down anyway.
Well, you know, it's so fascinating because in New York City, they're now talking about taking Columbus's statue down from Columbus Circle. And of course, it can't be denied that Columbus did not do well with Native Americans in terms of, you know, robbing them of their country. So there's always, and Washington had slaves. So it's always a question of what we do with our history.
Absolutely. And, you know, I like the idea that some people have been saying in some of these southern places, taking these monuments down and making them artifacts of history and putting them in museums so that they then can be talked about and thought about, because that's part of what museums do in our culture, in our society, is allow people to see and question what was that used for, what created that, why did they do that, and so it becomes a learning and teaching tool rather than a monument to enhance and to praise and create honor. It instead creates curiosity.
We've been talking with Massachusetts Senate President Stanley Rosenberg. Senator, this has been such a delight for me. I truly appreciate what you're doing and admire what you're doing. And I just love the fact that you've been as forthright with us today as you have been. And we thank you so much. You're always welcome here anytime. Thanks again for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you. I'll look forward to another opportunity. Take care. Happy summer to everyone.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.